Different. Escaping the Competitive Herd. Author, Young Mi Moon. The Competitive Herd. Imagine that you're standing in the middle of a cereal section of your local supermarket. Your job is to select a cereal you've never tried before, ideally, one you'll end up enjoying. How do you go about doing it? If you happen to be someone who has eaten cereal on an fairly regular basis throughout your life, the task is actually not that hard. The whole exercise would probably be over in a matter of minutes, unless of course you happen to be the type of person who is really persnickety about your breakfast fare, in which case, it might take a bit longer. Now imagine someone else standing in the same aisle, faced with the same task. What was easy for you would be completely daunting for him. Even assuming his superior intelligence, parsing the variation among products would take upon an hour. For this poor creature, all of those cereal boxes would be bewilderingly the same. Why? Because where a connoisseur sees the differences, a novice sees the similarities. Where a connoisseur can discern subtle shades of distinction, based on non-symmetries, a novice lacks the necessary filters to canvas, to organize, to shift an assortment in a meaningful way. Where a connoisseur can navigate a category with effortless intuition, a novice will struggle to find beginning, middle, or end. Shopping in this regard can be beyond experiential. It can be phenomenological. When competition gets problematic, as the number of products within a category multiplies, the differences between them start to become increasingly trivial, almost to the point of preposterousness. Try it. Pick a random product category such as soap, or cereal, or shoes, and make a list of what is different among the products within the category. The list will probably be long, but an overwhelming number of these differences will almost certainly be trifling. Put another way, the category has reached the point where it is possible for product heterogeneity to be experienced as product homogeneity, which is not to say that the distinctions between products are not real. It is simply to say that they are real only in the same way that synonyms have discrete connotations. Blue is dissimilar to red, in a different way than teal is dissimilar to navy. For business, this is when competing in the category can become problematic, because this is when it can require a category expert, a connoisseur, to negotiate the category with any kind of ease. How we cope. How do marketing managers know when they are succeeding? One obvious way is by looking at sales data, by looking at how many of us are buying their products. The problem is that this won't necessarily provide a full picture of our consumption attitudes. You and I may be actively purchasing the same brand, but this doesn't mean we are assigning the same meaning to our patronage. You may be consuming out of routine, or even reluctance, while I am consuming out of passion. In that event, I'm probably more committed to the brand than you are, which is another way of saying that I'm probably less likely to be tempted by competitive offerings. This is why, in addition to poring over sales data, marketing managers pay us so much attention to our public displays of brand affection. Anytime we're willing to publicize our brand affinity to the rest of the world, our connection to the brand is likely to be pretty robust, and marketers know this. From the perspective of a brand manager, an even better scenario is one which our brand passion is married to a second ingredient, a belief that brand delivers something that other brands do not, a belief that derives from obvious comparative diligence. A statement such as "I die for Brigham's Mint chocolate chip ice cream" could be considered a sturdy declaration of brand loyalty for two reasons. The extreme fervor in the statement implies passion, while the extreme specificity in the statement implies comparative expertise and astuteness within the respect to the particular benefits of Brigham's Mint chocolate chip versus another brand. Note that this comparative expertise doesn't necessarily have to be an objective, functional, or even rational basis. When someone insists on wearing only Hugo Boss shoes and Prada sunglasses, his fastidiousness may be based on highly subjective notions about the advantages of these brands versus their competition. No matter, his selectivity is still anchored in an informed awareness of his alternatives, which means that his brand loyalties are rooted in his differentiated benefits that are very real to him. In sum, when these two ingredients, passion and comparative expertise, yield the particular brand preference, they become tenacious in their combination for their express reason that they add up to a sense of irreplaceability. If you're a brand manager, this is precisely what you want. People who not only love your brand, but feel that it is the only brand available to deliver what they're looking for. Difference, hostility. One day in 1971, a young art director by the name of Harvey Gaber sat down to sketch out an idea for a new television advertisement. Gaber worked for McCann Erickson, Coca-Cola's advertising agency, and the spot he envisioned was both progressive and Panglosian. It depicted a throng of young people of various ethnicities, dressed in clothing representatives of their nationalities, gathered on a grassy hillside on the outskirts of Rome, singing the words to Coke's latest theme song. "I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. I'd like to buy the world a Coke and keep it company." The ad was released in the United States in the summer of 1971, and within months, Coca-Cola was receiving thousands of letters expressing enthusiasm for the spot, Even as the song was climbing to the top of the American pop music charts, over time, the Hilltop ad would earn its place among the most popular commercials in the annals of television. The achievement was particularly impressive given the context. 1971 was a raw and discordant time in the nation's history. It was the year New York Times would publish the Pentagon Papers, the year the newspapers were filled with stories of Nixon, Vietnam, the Black Panthers. And yet against this backdrop of social tumult and civic disaffection, Coca-Cola somehow managed to paint a tableau of unity and optimism. Every age liked it, Gaber told a journalist a few years ago. Grandma sang it. People were singing it in the office, and kids liked it. Of course, the advertisement doesn't look like much today. The lyrics seem hopelessly corny, the visuals stale, and hackneyed. But that's only because the aesthetics of advertising have evolved over the years. The point is, what Coca-Cola was able to do four decades ago is what brands continue to aspire to do today, to wrap their brands in an uplifting message that somehow manages to draw us in. In business, differentiation is everything. We all know it. In our business schools, we preach the importance of differentiation. In our executive suites, we build out strategies around these concepts of differentiation. Only those who dare to be different in times of similarities win.